Hey there, Rick Singeria, Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you could write your life in recipes, what would be included? I think my childhood would include beef stroganoff, dad's famous spaghetti with the secret ingredient, meat. My 20s would have to be seared salmon with a soy ginger cilantro glaze. And these days, sigh, it's Annie's mac and cheese with peas and whatever vegetables I can get my kids to eat. For Martin Phillip, it's all about the bread. He's the head baker at King Arthur Flour. Last year, he wrote a book that encapsulates his story in 75 recipes. The book starts with bread right, not birthright, bread right, biscuits, hoe cakes, plum port jam. The chapter Leaving is told through black-eyed peas, focaccia, tapenade. Then New York, bagels, brioche, poached pears, Vermont, oatmeal bread and baguettes. And there's more. The book is called Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes. Today, we're listening back to my conversation with Martin Phillip that first aired when the book came out about a year ago. In September, he won the Vermont Book Award for Breaking Bread. I began by asking him to take us back to his childhood with his early memories of his mother's drop biscuits.
Yeah. My feeling is that we all experience life in many ways, but we do have a common thread, and that thread ties back to food. We all eat regardless of race, religion, origin. It's a binding experience. And for me, my early food memories relate to the biscuits that my mother made in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. And from there, the sort of bond was set, and here I am at King Arthur going on 11 years.
What was it about those biscuits? What did they taste like? What are the ingredients now, and you tease them out on your tongue?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The biscuits of memory are different than the ones I make today. My mother's biscuits were maybe a little bit simpler. You know, they were a mixture of white flour and wheat flour. They were made without measuring anything. I think the line that I say in the book is that she measured baking powder between the heart and lifelines of her palm with a thimbleful of salt. Whereas today, as a professional baker, you know, I measure things mostly in grams. Occasionally, I cut a few corners. But those biscuits are as much about experience as they are flavor. It's the experience of home. It's the scent memory of home. It's the communion of home that carries through to today. And they were simple. And I say in the book, and they were dinner. We had a lot of nights where biscuits with some gravy were, that was the meal.
Would your kids recognize biscuits today as part of their idea of home? Or is their home, their baking, something maybe more elaborate now?
I wonder. You know, I think that probably, if we could fast forward a decade or two or four, I wonder what their memories would be. I think that they would recognize an intersection in our kitchen, which is marked in entry and exit with crumbs. You know, we have a big breadboard, and there's always a knife. And from the earliest days, as soon as they could reach the cutting board, we were teaching them how to saw on a loaf. So it would be biscuits, but it would also be crunchy baguettes, and it would be hearty pancakes in the morning, I hope. But who knows? Who knows what memories we're laying down together? I hope that baking is part of them, but ultimately that's theirs to sort of recollect.
Mm-hmm. You describe your mother, as you said, as somebody for whom a recipe was maybe a guideline and not
a suggestion.
Yeah, exactly. That's in pretty stark contrast, though, to her mother, your Oma, right? I mean, she was a recipe follower.
It's true. And you've obviously read through. You saw that Oma was about precision. She was a quilter and had incredible skills with textiles, you know, 10 stitches per inch when she's quilting layettes and crocheting. And my mother came into those skills, but my mother sort of turned it upside down and found ways to improvise and to honor tradition and at the same time look forward. And I feel like those two distinct lines landed in my lap. And so as a professional baker, And as someone who's interested in pushing the envelope of what we do now, I think that I have both lines. I have my mother's sort of chaos and creativity, and I have Omaha's adherence to what we've received from those who've come before us. And I feel like that's a unique gift.
We got a note from Nichol in Guilford who says, I don't really have any questions, but this is basically a fan letter to King Arthur's Flower. King Arthur is truly a wonderful resource, not only their products, but as a source of information and education, most notably for me, their books and online presence. Nichol says, I've never been able to cook or bake anything in my life as much as I had wanted to, but with King Arthur's help, I've learned a great deal. No one will ever mistake me for a great baker like Mr. Philip, but the ability to share a well-baked dessert or a loaf of bread with friends and family has meant a lot to me. And that's what it's all about, really, isn't it, Martin? I mean, that idea of sharing something that you've made from the heart?
I think so. I think that if we look back, like way, way back, I think that communities were formed around food systems, right? And I think of the round form, the circle of people maybe gathering around a fire, passing food. That to me is the seed of community that began and grew and around which agrarian communities formed. And so I feel like food is at the heart of it. And if we can begin there, I feel like that's the right place to be. And I think food and cooking and sharing and those communities are more important now than ever. It helps us to understand others. It helps us to get back to what's important.
Can you describe along those lines what you think of as bread right?
Yeah, so bread right is a term that fell out of use in, I think, around the 16th century. But if you think about other rights like wheelwright or playwright, cartwright, right was a term that meant worker. And so I feel like bread right spoke to me because it ties me back to someone who provided an essential for society, for communities. And I feel like that's an honorable trait. And I was at a place years ago where I was out of touch with that. I wasn't doing anything with my hands, or I wasn't doing anything that I felt contributed to the fabric of our society. And bread and baking bread got me back to that. And now I'm so thrilled to, on a daily basis, be making treats and staples for our community here. So I feel lucky.
You know, it's interesting, though, at the beginning of your book, again, you ruminate on this idea of lineage and what men pass down, like their names, and what women pass down, like their recipes. So you are doing something with your hands, which can go either way in either gender traditionally. But have you sort of twisted that traditional script by becoming a baker and really embracing and taking your grandmother's and your mother's skills and their heritage and embracing them?
I think so. And I think that hopefully what I meant to do in the book was not so much identify gender roles, but really just look at how have we as a society quantified the contributions of either side. And the men in my family had trades that were quantifiable. We could go and look at census documents. And my name Martin comes from Martin Chamberlain of Shortsville, New York, who was a cooper who built barrels and drained them. He died of cirrhosis in 1919, you know. And then on the other side, the women who were nurturing in round forms, whether arms held around a child or around a mixing bowl. So I feel like maybe I have turned it upside down some, but I feel more like I've been able to combine the best of what I've gotten from both sides in terms of trade and also nurturing community, compassion, and providence.
Will you tell us about one of the recipes that's in this beginning part of your book where you're sort of tracing your lineage and your introduction to food and how it's shaped you?
Yeah, there's an easy one. I grew up where in an environment where all of the bread that we ate came from the hands of either my mother or my father. Every weekend, my mother would make 20 loaves. She'd mix the dough, or my father would mix the dough. And then they'd leave it on the counter to rise for some period of time. They didn't set timers. Sometimes there's dough going down the cupboards, and I'm sure if you went back to that house, maybe you'd see some remnants. But so there's a recipe in there for something I call Mama's Bread. And basically it's that staple bread, that simple bread that one could live on. And half whole wheat, half white flour, a little bit of fat, salt, a little bit of honey or sugar. And it's a bread that I make on occasion at home today. But, you know, we lived off that stuff. And I think that was unique to me. I didn't – my friends were – you know, you take that to school in the lunchbox and the other kids have some bread out of a plastic bag and it's squishy and you can wad it up and throw it at each other. But – and, you know, there was a period of time where I wish that I had that bread, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I feel like now I'm back to a place where I'm so proud of that bread that I put it in the beginning of the book because I feel like it was foundational to me to see that, to see my parents making and providing. And so Mama's Bread, one of those early things that resonates early on in the book for sure.
Yeah, you have a picture of it, too, in the book, and it looks like a hearty loaf of, you know, whole wheat bread. It's a little browner than I expected from half whole wheat and half white flour. But, yeah, it looks just like, you know, a lovely loaf of totally respectable whole wheat bread.
Exactly. And that's that was baked in the home oven at my house. And a good bake on it, you know, remember that as loaves brown in the oven, that browning is flavor. It comes from the Maillard reaction, which is, you know, the same as you get when you sear meats. So that nice deep flavor brings in good crust flavor in sort of contrast to the crumb structure and crumb flavors. So, yeah, that's a good loaf.
Well, so we'll do as you do in the book and marry story and skill. So what is the right way to think about when your bread is done and how to test it without ruining it by sticking a fork in it?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, the best way to know when bread is done is to bake a lot of bread. It's one of those things where some people will use a thermometer as you would when you're cooking a roast or maybe a chicken breast or something else. But I think ultimately the best tools that we have are our senses. And so over time, you know, with baking and with practice, we gain those empirical tools which allow us to sense by the weight of the loaf, the smell of the loaf, the visual appearance of the loaf. And then also, obviously, it's best to start with a good roadmap. So do you have a good recipe that's tried and true? I know at King Arthur we have some recipes on the website which are sort of sure things. You know, if you've never baked bread before, this is a good place to start. So begin with a good roadmap, bake a lot, then use your best intuition and your empirical knowledge, and I guarantee you'll be eating with a big smile.
When you say bake a lot, I mean, does it help then to bake the same recipe or the same basic style of bread a lot? Because then you do have a sense of, you know, how it behaves differently depending on the weather and depending on how much you've kneaded it and how long you've kept it in the oven versus, you know, now I'm going to do this style and now I'm going to do this style. And they all look different and they feel different and they have a slightly different texture.
No, I think that's very valid. And, you know, if we think about learning anything, you know, how long did it take you in radio to get to where you could come to an interview and know and have some sense of being – you're assured of which way to go, what question to ask next. You know, you gain this sort of knowledge. It's craft, you know. So it takes time. It takes repetitions. Jumping around is also fun. But I say if you want to hone your skills – keep it simple for a little while. Do the same recipe day in and day out. Even in a professional bakery, 7 days a week, 360 days a year, we're open here. And I guarantee you that the baguettes are always within a range, but we see differences, you know, when the air is humid, when the air is dry, when it's warm, when it's cold, ambient conditions affect everything. So, you know, go with patience, but also go with your best awareness and your best focus, too. And I think you'll be baking really well. Do you bake, Jane?
You know, I used to bake more, and now I've got two very small kids and
yep.
This job. And I find, you know, I love this idea of taking the time and practicing. And I really do lament the lack of time I feel like I have. And I guess maybe I just haven't made it a priority.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, yeasted products do take longer. But remember that things like biscuits and things like scones – there's a wonderful flatbread, like whole wheat roti, in the book that can be made in really a modicum of active time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that can get kids involved. And this, for me, is kind of at the heart of it because getting them involved, and granted, if you've got a kid under 2 or 3 years old, it's like,
yeah.
Keep them out of the kitchen. You know, it's going to be messy. But once they get to a certain age, they are so engaged. And it can even be mood altering or mood lifting to get them in that process and get them making. And it's just eyes go wide open and then the mouth. So it's special.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I totally agree. My grandmother in Maine, it was every time we were visiting, she would invite me to make bread with her. And those are some of my most cherished memories.
It's gold, right? It's
yeah.
Absolute gold.
Let's go to Kevin, who's calling in from San Diego, California. Hi, Kevin. You're a long way away.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. I've been baking self-taught sourdough, and I've kind of focused in on semolina bread, and I've been probably done 500-600 pounds of it over the years. So I wanted to comment on that. But first, in terms of technique, the one thing that I can't find in any of the books is what's a good surface, or maybe your two favorite surfaces for kneading and working with bread, especially here in California where everything's damn tile, countertops, it's not very efficient. And so what's a solution when you have a tile countertop?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
My questions.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Kevin. And thanks for calling all the way from San Diego. Dang. Semolina bread sounds great. We make some semolina at least 2 or 3 days a week here in the bakery, and we're using patent semolina, which is a finer milling than what you might find for use on pizza peels and things like that. But it's a great flour. Semolina is grown in North Dakota. It's a very hard grain, often used for pasta making as well. In terms of surfaces for kneading, so I have an approach to kneading which I think is a little bit backwards looking and may even predate this idea of mechanically working the dough with your hands. I don't actually knead anything in the book, and that doesn't make the book no knead. What I actually do is I just mix to combine in a mixing bowl, and then I let it rest, and then I do what are called folds. And what happens is, briefly, gluten forms in the presence of water. And so when we hydrate the flour, the gluten begins to form and develop. And if we just leave the dough and then come back and fold it, we can actually get the same or better results than if we actively work the dough with our hands. If I were to knead at home and I had a tile counter, I would look for something which is like a wooden cutting board overlay for your tile counter. I find those useful to work on. I don't like necessarily working on tile because it's hard to clean. Here in the bakery, we exclusively use maple block tables. They're actually rock maple. They're bulletproof, and we've had the same benches for 15 years now. I can't even count. Probably we're into the millions of baguettes that have been shaped on those benches now. So I like wood, if that's helpful.
So you like wood over something like marble?
Yeah, I prefer that because in shaping, we actually use the bench to create tension. In addition to our hands, we use the bench to create tension. And wood has a nice balance of being something that dough adheres to, and yet if lightly dusted, will release dough. So it's the perfect sort of balance. And I guarantee if you go into most artisan bakeries, that's what we're working on, our wooden tables.
And what about the bowl that you leave the bread to rise in?
Yeah.
Does it matter what kind of material you're using for that?
I like
as well?
A big metal mixing bowl that I can get my hands into, and the metal is lighter to work with than glass. I'm also worried about breaking the glass. So just a big, cheap metal mixing bowl, and I'm very happy. That plus some hands and a good digital scale, that's about what I need to make bread. Plus flour. Plus
right.
flour.
Yes, and a little bit of water.
Exactly.
And maybe some yeast.
Maybe an oven someplace
yeah.
too, right?
Right. Today we are listening back to an interview from last year with Martin Phillip, head baker at King Arthur Flour and author of the book Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes. The book just won the Vermont Book Award this past September. We had a lot of listener response to this show, including a note from Chris in Middlebury, who wrote in to ask, is there a personality difference between people who cook without recipes and those who have to follow a recipe precisely? Here's Martin Phillips' answer.
I think it's a great question. You know, I have a confession. So we eat pancakes a couple days a week at my house, and it's always a mixture of what grain or what flour I have on hand. Do I have apples in the fridge that I could grate? Do I have bananas? Is there something that I need to move, you know? And so there's this sort of weekly improvisation that might, from the outside, look more like cooking than baking. If we think of cooking as, you know, pinches of that and tasting this. But I think that if you get in a little bit closer, you'll realize that I've come to know the ratios between ingredients, and I'm able to sort of have this playful interaction and put good pancakes out each week. So I would say, yeah, there are definitely some personality differences. And I think sometimes people come to me and say, oh, you know, I'm getting this book from my husband because I would never follow those recipes. And I say, okay. But at its core, I think that when food is interesting is when it has a connection to your heart. So I think that if you're that person who likes to improvise, I say, go for it. Maybe, you know, pay attention to some ratios along the way if you want to bake. Or if you're that person who likes to follow recipes, I think you should do that and enjoy the journey. But yeah, for sure there's a difference between the people who will follow and won't follow. So yeah, I agree with you, Chris.
You were mentioning a few minutes ago the white bread sandwiches that your classmates had, and how there were times when you were bringing in your homemade bread that you felt a little bit ashamed and wished you had what they had. And Dan wrote in to say, oh my God, a professional baker who knows about blast sandwiches when you pack Wonder Bread into balls and throw it at your brother.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, you see that bread as a kid, you know, you don't want to do anything to be that chicken in the chicken house that has spots. You know, it's like, oh, man, I'm going to get pecked. Mm-hmm. So you try to sort of keep yourself in line. But I don't know, at this point, I wouldn't trade any of that for that yellow mouth ring of Cheetos and Smuckers stuck to the roof of your mouth, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, it was I got the school lunch, and that's what made me a pariah. Everybody else had what you were looking at too, but you know, I was getting the sausage links that you could bounce off the gym floor.
Oh man, I would have died for those.
Let's go to Heather, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Heather. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, so sorry. Hi, my name's Heather. I'm from Shelburne. I run a home child care, and I have six kids with me on a daily basis. And I just wanted to say, one, I love the conversation today. And two, we love King Arthur flour, and that's all we use here. But I have most of my kids are four and under. I have one four-year-old. The rest are three and under. And we bake weekly. We make bread weekly, each of them with their own bowl. And I just wanted to say that I think it's just a huge gift to give kids to get them in the kitchen as young as one, two, and three. And we do it on a regular basis, and the bread comes out great. Honestly, I think bread is easy.
Yeah.
And my kids are finding that that's true as well. So thank you so much for the conversation, but I really encourage kids to get into the kitchen as soon as possible.
Heather, you're wonderful, and I can only imagine the vacuuming up of flour on the walls and the floor. And it sounds wonderful, Martin.
I think it is wonderful, and thank you, Heather. And, you know, those kids are getting something that is so unique and so special, and you're laying down some good roots for them to continue this path of making. Who knows how long, you know? That's super.
And Stephen is on the line with us from Gansfort, New York. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Oh.
I love the smell, the feel, and the taste of baked bread and
Oh, Stephen, your line is too rough for us to use. So call back, see if you can get to a spot that has better reception, and we'll see if we can get you on the air again. In the meantime, Stephanie's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Stephanie. Go right ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I'm sort of a kitchen hack, and I found a bread maker for $8, grabbed it, and with the cost of bread being so expensive, I've taken this, you know, old bread maker, and I'm trying to figure it out. It's been a little challenging, and I'm wondering, do you have any tips or tricks or advices for someone like me?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would hunt around and look for recipes that are specifically signed, you know, designed for bread machines. It's not that the ratios between flour, water, salt, and yeast would change necessarily, but you might find things that get you off on the right foot in terms of putting the right amount of those ingredients into that bread machine, because you don't want to put in too much and then the top comes off, or it won't bake properly, or not enough and it bakes too fast. So I would search around a little bit and see if you can find some recipes that are associated with that model, and then come on back. But in the end, Stephanie, you might even find that it's as easy to just bust out a mixing bowl and put those ingredients in, mix them by hand, and then get yourself a pan and bake in the oven. It may be a shorter route to hot bread with dinner, you know?
Uh-oh, are you evangelizing now?
Am I? You know, I might be. Keep it simple.
Sylvia is calling in from Heartland. Hi, Sylvia. What are you thinking
Sylvia.
About?
Hi, Martin and Jane. Martin, it's wonderful to hear you and hear all of your terrific stories. I just got back from a trip to Switzerland where I'm sure you know there's a long and wonderful tradition of baking and of working with older grains. And there seems to be currently a lot of interest in what they're calling Urdinkel, which is landrace varieties of spelt. And I'm wondering what the current state is and the current thinking is at King Arthur of working with more ancient grains and also with working with grains that are being grown in Vermont.
I think there's a great amount of interest. We're fortunate here in that we have a 40-centimeter stone mill that we brought over from Austria a few years ago, and we're able to make bread almost every day with a portion of fresh milled flour. And the value of that is that we're able to source grain from very small producers should we want to, and also some of the niche grains like some of the older spelt. It also is a way which bakers can see the connection between these glass-hard grains and something edible. And that's so enriching and so invigorating for us. Spelt is a beautiful old grain, slightly weaker in protein, but with incredible nutty flavor. And I hope that we continue to grow more and more of those grains, which are sort of on the periphery now. And I think we are, and I know that in the bakery, we're certainly moving in that direction with the advent of the mill and also other formulas which contain buckwheat. People may not know that, you know, so some of those niche grains are definitely coming in. They're flavorful. They're often more nutritious in terms of whole grain content. So they're exciting. It's an exciting time to be a baker for sure. And especially here at King Arthur, I feel.
I imagine you must have to, again, do more experimentation, but also read up a little bit on how different grains behave, because it's not going to be exactly the same, right, if you're swapping grains.
It's true. It's true. It's not something to do sort of willy-nilly, but I think at the same time, it's not as daunting as one might think. You may not want to try and make a spelt baguette, but certainly spelt shortbread, spelt scones, even a portion of spelt flour and a biscuit. All totally reasonable and easy ways to incorporate more whole grain or grains that you may not know as much about. They work really well.
So Wayne in Richmond, New Hampshire says, my holy grail, 100% sourdough. Can it be done without making a brick?
I hope so. We do 100% sourdough probably 7 days a week. A lot of good other bakeries around like Red Hen up in Middlesex. So, you know, it can definitely be done. Probably if you're ending up baking bricks, you might look at your hydration. Just make sure you've got enough water in the recipe. And also make sure that you're measuring ingredients by weight, not by cups. Cups work well maybe once you have some empirical knowledge. But I would say in the beginning, the best way to set yourself up for success is through the measurement, through measurements, even in grams. Much better way to proceed.
Martin, is it true you say you've never actually been 100% satisfied with what you're creating and this wonderful stuff? You can be head baker at King Arthur and still not be 100% satisfied?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I've come close, you know. There have been a few days where I felt like, okay, you know, we're headed into the home stretch. Everything that I've baked thus far today, and we're talking maybe 500 or 600 kilos, which is, what is that in pounds? A lot. You know, 1,000 pounds. Everything's coming out and it's pretty good, but maybe, you know, the baguettes could have been a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that, but that's okay. That's okay. It's okay to be in that place where what we do, this craft, has some room for improvement. If it were perfect, I don't know, it might, my love of it might somehow shrink a little bit because I feel like I have something to grow into. There's still something that I can continue to make, you know, this relationship even sweeter with. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if it, once you've hit success, what else is to strive for?
Yeah. And it's there. It's chaotic. You know, dough is a living substrate, if you think about it, which responds to heat, temperature, ambient conditions. It's, you know, you're herding cats a little bit. So it always has that learning curve. And I think that maybe I'd be in the same position if I were, you know, a woodworker. Maybe if I were making rocking chairs, there would always be that thing where I'd say, I love that chair, but I wish there was a little bit of grain here or something like that. So it's good. It may sound like it's not resting, but it is. I enjoy the work and I enjoy the pursuit of these beautiful things.
Craig in Moncton wrote in to say, we are sourdough people at our house and we bake pretty frequently, but I recently found out about red fife flour. I wonder what you think about using this type of flour as a primary flour in bread making and maybe a good recipe to try.
Red fife is a great variety. I couldn't recall the exact sort of how it came to pass in back into use, but red fife is a single variety of wheat. So the wheat that we normally use is often a blend. It's a blend of varieties, but red fife is a single variety, very flavorful, and one that I think we give the sort of heirloom stamp to. Should work well in anything that you're baking, absolutely.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're listening back to an interview from last year with Martin Phillip, head baker at King Arthur Flour and the author of the book Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes. The book won the Vermont Book Award this September. Stephen from Gansworth, New York, called into the show with this question.
I so love baking and feeling and smelling fresh bread. Unfortunately, I have associated myself with someone who's become or has always been perhaps gluten intolerant. I've got all sorts of different flours at home. I've yet to start experimenting and listing what works and what doesn't. Any good suggestions on something that will help me to get a good risen bread that's gluten-free?
Boy, that's I think that's a tough one. I think there are techniques and there are some starches that you can use as well as some mixes out there that can be used to make bread. Stephen, my expertise is maybe along the lines of you. I love smelling, eating, tasting, but my real knowledge base relates to sort of products which include gluten. I do like to make some gluten-free stuff, and I do mess around with loaves using buckwheat flour. And I also like, you know, buckwheat pancakes, and some of those items work really well. You know, gluten is the structural network that allows us to build bread skyscrapers, you know? And if we remove it, it's hard to find another material. There really is no substitute. But I do think there are some mixes out there which can help people to enjoy bread in somewhat the same way. And you do get some of the nice smell. I mean, those organic chemicals that come off during baking, those will also be present when you're baking some gluten-free loaves. So hunt around a little bit. And if you have some more specific questions, like Jane said, post them on the Facebook page, and I'll check in there and see what I can do to point you in the direction of some resources, okay?
Oh, wonderful. You know, speaking, though, to what Stephen's talking about here with gluten-free, you know, we are in the midst of, I don't want to call it a trend, I'm not trying to pass any judgment, but,
sure.
You know, there's particular food directions that people are going in, and, you know, we see this gluten-free, paleo, low-carb is popular. And then there's also this sort of vilification of things like the $4 toast that Morrisville native Josie Baker popularized in the Bay Area several years ago, and a sort of backlash against really good bread. So what are you seeing, you know, from your position at King Arthur in this sort of anti-gluten or anti-good bread time we're in?
Yeah, it's tough. And certainly we want to first and foremost honor people who have health issues related to eating gluten. And I'm not in that position, so it's important to me to just remember that, to be empathetic, to try and think of ways which we might serve them. In the bakery, it's easier to do some sweet things than it is to do breads, because there are things that have been made throughout history that don't necessarily contain gluten and can be produced as they always were at a very high quality without using a wheat flour. The advent of bread made without gluten is a newer thing, and I would say that we're still definitely trying to unlock it. But it's difficult in a production bakery environment because if you come into the bakery, you know, you have skin contact with the wheat flour. You know, it's in the air. It's in everything that we do. So it's hard for us to really work in a true gluten-free environment. But I keep experimenting. A close friend has celiac disease, and I've done some bread making in pursuit of trying to find something that's edible and delicious. And I would say we've gotten close, but we have work to do.
Well, tell us another recipe then from something in your book, you know, from the later chapters that maybe is less traditional. Or, I mean, you also, I should point out, have recipes that are not bread. You know, you have a pizza sauce recipe, you have jams, you have other things, as I said, preserved pears, poached pears. So
yeah.
It's not just bread in your recipes.
Yeah. So the things that are interesting me, or when I begin to develop a new bread, the things that really are interesting me is, to me, is what is the connection that I have to the ingredients? What is the narrative power of the ingredients that we're using? And so if I think of examples in there, there's a bread that we're making in the bakery right now with cheese from Vermont Farmstead. So we know the folks over there, and we get the cheese from them. We cure our own jalapenos, and I put that recipe in the book. It has some soaked cornmeal in it. And so I like this intersection of a bread that is expected and at the same time unexpected because we bring ingredients in which carry narrative power. I put another bread in the book, which is a bread made with a lot of rye flour, and it also incorporates boiled cider from Woods Boiled Cider in Vermont. And I like that because it creates this intersection between what we've always done and where we might grow in terms of incorporating local producers who have excellent flavored products. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of producers and knowing your producers, we got a note from Tom who says, "My uncle is a wheat grower in Kansas who supplies King Arthur Flour with his whole white wheat. Martin, you may know my uncle Charles Ayers, who's been preserving this variety for decades and now has formed a growers co-op to supply you and others. We were growing this wheat years ago, but sending it into all the commodity feed industry for beef cows. Now it has a market as baking has enjoyed a renaissance. I wanted to give a shout out to Charlie and the other wheat growers out there, and also to ask if you believe there's a qualitative difference in the baking quality of grains grown in different regions."
Yeah, first, I would say I think what he's talking about is Farmers Direct and some of the identity preserved wheat that we're sourcing from Kansas. And that's a special project, and it's producing some gorgeous, gorgeous flour that I am super excited to work with. In terms of sort of, I think what he's saying is basically the terroir of wheat, and absolutely. Wheat is an agricultural crop, so like grapes or corn or tomatoes, the conditions, environmental and otherwise, within which it's grown certainly will have an effect on what we get out of the ground and how it tastes and how it performs. And I don't know, that's infinitely interesting and exciting to me to see those things and how they play out in the final product. And does bread taste different made with wheat from Vermont than from Maine or New York State or Kansas? Absolutely. I hope so. And let's preserve that. It's exciting, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about food is that idea of terroir and that idea that it has a different flavor and, you know, maybe different texture of all the food. You know, we talk about it a lot with maple syrup, too.
Absolutely.
One caller who's been waiting on the line is Peter, who's in Charlotte. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. A couple of things. One is I can really relate to it, the emotional connection with baking. I bake once a week. And if I'm uptight or hurrying around trying to do something, too many things at once, the bread just doesn't turn out well. But if I'm really in a relaxed place and focused, it's much better. My specific question has to do with getting moldy too soon. I like to bake once a week. I use probably a little bit more sweetener than I should. I use molasses, maple syrup, and honey. But, you know, I get mold even in the wintertime after seemingly 4 or 5 days. Do you think it's the sweetener or is it something else I'm doing wrong?
That's a good question. So are you leaving it in a plastic bag on the kitchen counter or something?
Yep. Okay. That's where I leave it.
Yeah. So always in a plastic?
Always in a plastic.
Yeah, okay. So what I would recommend now is the plastic twist tied and fully sealed, or do you leave it to where it has a little bit of room for air to move in and out?
You got it. Twist sealed.
All right. There. So two things. One, let some air in and out because you've got this sort of you need to have some air exchange. Otherwise, moisture is going to build up, especially if you bag it really soon. So that's one. Two, if you bake 4 loaves of the week, freeze 2 of them, pull them midweek, and let them sort of thaw overnight, and I think that you'll retard molding that way. Don't keep it in the fridge. Bread doesn't belong in the fridge. It belongs on the counter or in the freezer.
I had heard once that, especially if you have a crusty loaf, just put it cut side down on a cutting board. And
That's absolutely correct. In the wintertime, you may find that you need a loose sort of plastic bag over the top just to prevent the drying. Ambient conditions are so dry that they'll suck moisture out. But yes, always cut side down on the cutting board with a knife and butter ready.
So for somebody who's never baked bread before and, you know, is enjoying this conversation but thinking, yep, not for me. I mean, I know you're an evangelist. We've already, you know, figured that out. So what do you say to people who think, I don't have the time and I, you know, is it really going to taste that much better?
I think that we need both makers and eaters. And I think that if you're not drawn to making it, go buy some bread or find a friend. But if you want to try it out, why not? But I think we need people in the audience. We need people on stage. We need people who are eating, and we need people at the hot oven at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Boy, well, you know, Martin Phillips says in the beginning of his book that, boy, he'd never written before. He didn't know if he could do it. And I'll tell you, you can tell just by the way he talks, he's got a poet's voice, and it comes through in the text of this book. It's called Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes. Martin Phillips, also the head baker at King Arthur Flour in Norwich. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Jane, what an honor. Thank you for having me on.